Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this is Bookin', brought to you by our new presenting sponsor, the North Carolina Book Festival, one of North Carolina's many amazing premier literary events. Happy to host North Carolina's many amazing authors, along with national and international bestsellers, prize winners, independent authors, and my guest today is award-winning author Callie Fedorick. Her new novel is Attaboy, which is published by our friends at University of Iowa Press. Callie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. I'm happy to be here.
It's an honor to have you here. And first, Callie, before we dive into your novel, you're published by the University of Iowa Press. What has it been like working with them, and how did you hook up with them?
I've been extremely happy. Like a lot of smaller presses nowadays, they punch well above their weight. And they're the ones taking the risks that the big honchos in Manhattan might not be willing to take. So I encourage all aspiring writers to think beyond the big five, or is it four or three? I'm not sure. And I don't mean to sound like a hater for big presses. I love much of the output of big presses, but I just... we were free of this sort of trial by committee and the clogged pipeline, production pipeline that goes into a lot of New York City based publishing, I imagine. I undertook the querying and submission process with a lot of confidence and hope, but, you know, a little bit of trepidation. I never questioned that there was an audience for the book. I think I know tons of people who would dig it, but I sensed, rightly, I think, that some of the gatekeepers standing between me and that audience, gatekeepers whose job it is in some ways to be cautious and risk averse and to play devil's advocate about the market viability of whatever comes across their desks, that those people would have a little trouble knowing what to make of it. The book is, you know, it's not quite hard-boiled enough for the crime fiction set, nor is it like mushy enough for the literary crowd. It's a little too mainstream for indie, too indie for mainstream. So I was just waiting for that group of people who would say, you know what, screw the algorithm. We love this and we want to go ahead with this. And I found those people in Jim McCoy and the Iowa team. And I'm so grateful that I did.
Yeah, absolutely. Screw the algorithm, indeed. That could be our motto here on the Book and Podcast. Yeah, I'm confused whether it's a big three, four, five, because Penguin Random House is buying everyone. Not
aiming to make money.
Yeah, I mean, it's capitalism. You got to play the game that you're
in. I get it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much, Callie. I'm now hoping you can take a moment to set this novel, Attaboy, up for our listeners.
Certainly. So I think of it as a large-hearted crime comedy coming-of-age tale. It's about Rudy Coyle, the protagonist. He's a young man, a bit of a ne'er-do-well, a bit of a drifter, a working-class Irish-American kid. I say kid, but he's really sort of your prototypical man-child. He's from Flushing, Queens. He, in the first chapter, has a falling out with his hardline, socially regressive father, loses his would-be inheritance, the family-owned Irish bar in Midtown Manhattan, and by a stroke of luck, he finds employment as a temporary night doorman in a very fancy Park Avenue apartment building. Definitely a stomping ground of the 1%. And there he develops a bit of a bromance with one of the residents, a charismatic taxi cab mogul whose industry is now suffering from a major debt crisis, as well as a wider crisis of conscience. So Rudy finds himself becoming a bit of a right-hand man to this guy, Jake, and rises in the ranks of his sometimes shadowy business empire. So Rudy's story takes up a great deal of airspace, but it's also balanced by the secondary narrator, Marley Cohen, who is Jake's 13-year-old daughter. And she's growing up in an environment probably, you know, best known to the masses via something like Gossip Girl. She's a really tony Upper East Side girl school where she's friendless. She's, you know, a play on the poor little rich girl prototype. But hey, you know, these cliches persist for a reason, because there's always something new to make of them. And, you know, Marley's coming to terms with all her classic adolescent strife, you know, her budding sexual awareness, her parents' disintegrating marriage, and the collapse of the family business and her dad's increasingly embattled reputation. So there's this balance between two coming of age stories, coming of age, the classic age of 13, 14. And then what, you know, I've experienced in my own life so far is the real kicker, the coming of age that happens in your late 20s when you're kind of laying to rest some delusions of grandeur and running aground for the first time and, you know, finding that the youthful hubris that once buffeted you is running out and you're just no longer classically like in your face young. So I wanted to, these were two very important ages to me and I wanted to find a way to pay homage to them in a slightly non-traditional coming of age story.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that setup. Callie, did you go to an MFA program?
I did not go to what most people would call an MFA program, a traditional MFA program. I attended a master's of creative writing at Oxford University that was low residency. Mm-hmm. And I hesitate to besmirch it in any way because it was a wonderful experience. I met my husband. It was tons of fun. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in retrospect, I'm grateful that it was not very hands-on instruction. I think I probably spent 45 minutes in the whole time workshopping fiction. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of grateful for that. I think I would have even worsened the case of the yips that a lot of emerging writers feel, having their peers breathing down their necks and picking apart their stories and the infancy phase. This might sound arrogant, and it's actually not. I think every writer is an autodidact. I think like you just have to teach yourself through trial and error and just through reading voraciously. For those on the fence about whether or not an MFA is necessary, I would say the single best thing about any kind of, whether it's an MST in Oxford or more traditional, more rigorous MFA in the States, is the gift of time, you know, the gift of sort of pressing snooze on your career or personal life and just telling people, I'm a writer, this is what I'm here to do for now. That's the single most valuable thing other than any instruction per se. So yeah, I don't really identify as an MFA grad, mm-hmm. but I certainly think, you know, if it can kind of keep the devil off your back for a few years and you can afford it, go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I asked is because one of the things that I really enjoy about this novel, Attaboy, is the tone and the author, like, you know, your voice as a writer. And I can tell that it has not gone through an assembly line as I talk to you. So that's very cool. It makes sense that you went to this low residency program. I'm now going to ask you several questions about situations your characters find themselves. And then my next question is about dumb tattoos. There's a moment when your character is looking at tattoos before fully waking up, and the tattoos look dumb. And my question is, are all tattoos dumb, or is this a thing where if you stare at anything long enough, it starts to look questionable?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think any evidence of your former self can be embarrassing. Mm-hmm. During those first moments when you're still sort of, it's the very first moment of the book actually portraying him sort of waking up leery eyed and like that mm-hmm. moment before you sort of make a pact with consciousness, like, okay, we're doing this. We're here. Yeah, I am me. Where you're just like, oh, who the fuck am I? And why did I insist on being so special as to like emblazon myself with these very grandiose statements about my identity? I do have a couple tattoos. I think they're dumb. I don't think other people's tattoos are dumb, but I just think tattoos are such a great symbol of something you do to declare your difference. But at a certain point, you just look like someone with tattoos, you know, like actually it kind of does the opposite of what you think. It's a rare person I know who doesn't have tattoos, and I think they're kind of cooler for it. But, you know, all due respect to tattoo enthusiasts, I have a couple and they were great stories and I'm glad to bear those wounds.
Yeah.
Do you have tattoos?
I do. I have several tattoos. Yeah. And, you know, I probably feel the same way about them you do. I'm not, you know, sad that I got them or anything, but I certainly got them at a phase in my life that I'm no longer in. And I suspect that is the case with many folks. Well, can you now talk about New York exhaustion and what it is? How is New York exhaustion different from, say, Iowa exhaustion?
It's a really good question. I've never lived anywhere else really for a substantial amount of time. So New York exhaustion is exhaustion for me. It is existential exhaustion. It is fear of the future and longing for the past and regret distilled in a place. So I hardly have an unbiased or clear-eyed view of it. I think because our experience of New York City is so filtered through the media and through like decades and decades of film and images, you're always sort of contending with your own experience of it and then this one that's been imposed from without. But I, again, because I've lived there so long, it's hard for me to separate that particular ennui from any other existential ennui.
Yeah, I mean, it's different. You know, I've lived probably the largest city I've lived in was San Francisco, which I lived in for many years. At the point of time that I lived there, San Francisco had become more expensive than Manhattan, which it no longer is. But I assume that the levels of exhaustion are sort of similar. Maybe in San Francisco there was more like patchouli involved or something, but yeah, but then, you know, I just moved back to Raleigh, North Carolina, which in the 2 years that I have been gone has blown up as a city. And even when I lived here before, it had grown as a city, nowhere near the level of New York. But before this, I was in Aspen, Colorado, which is like you had to drive 45 minutes to get to a McDonald's. It's just literally out in the middle of nowhere. But it's also a town where like billionaires are chasing out millionaires. And yeah, different levels of existential crises everywhere, I suppose. Well, I'm now hoping that you can talk about working in a bar. I'm not sure if you've ever worked in a bar, but your characters have and are thinking about it. I've worked in a bar when I was an undergrad. How is working in a bar different from, say, working in a different service industry job?
Oh, I mean, I did work in a bar for 3 years after college. And you know, this was not a part-time thing. This was 6, sometimes 7 days a week, and not a high octane clubby environment either. There was a lot of sitting around and with old timers and grizzled alcoholics and really going deep with folks. And I think I developed a real, it really informed my sense of what life in New York is like, you know, how thankless and graceless it can be, but what a privilege it is. You know, I went deep with some certifiable eccentrics, you know, people who live in their fourth floor walk up with their pet squirrel on Avenue D and are damn proud of it and deserve to be because, you know, it beats the hell out of being sad and closeted in their hometown. I mean, for some people, it really is New York or nowhere. Like, it sounds like quite a hollow mantra, but I think it really is true for some people that the cost of living is absolutely worth it. And I think though Rudy, the protagonist in the first scene, which is set in a bar, feels some disdain for his customers, I also hope that the affection for barflies is apparent. Yeah, I think working in a bar, you go so much deeper, partly due to alcohol and partly just due to the format. You know, people come there to hang out, not to get their latte and be on their way.
Yeah, absolutely. The bar I worked in was in Columbia, South Carolina, when I was an undergrad. And bars there were open until 4 a.m., which is
Same.
2 hours later than most places. Yeah. And they were on the mini bottle system. So you couldn't do free pour. It was like everyone had to order a mini bottle and they would get, you know, one shot split three ways or something like that because they had to order the whole bottle. And I'm not going to say the name of the bar because I don't want to out anyone. But there was one night I was at work. The owner, who was never there, came in and spoke with his son, who is the manager. They were like huddled in a booth, you know, having a very serious conversation, it appeared. The bar closed at 4 a.m. The son decides to open sleeves of many bottles and just get the whole staff just, you know, drunk and wasted. And then the next morning I got a call and they're like, "You don't have to come to work today. The bar burnt down."
Oh my God.
Yeah,
And oh my goodness. Well,
Definitely an insurance situation, I think.
family. Yeah.
4
4 a.m. I mean, did you often work that late? 'Cause I remember thinking 4 a.m. seemed
Yes.
so implausible. Like, are we sure? Do we really want to die on this hill? But then, sure enough, there's the 345 Brigade who are just so happy to find that there's still a bar that's open. And it's like, if we can be a haven for these stragglers, I guess it's worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Kelly. Listeners, we're going to take a break here for a word from Libro FM Audiobooks, and then I will be right back. Kelly Fedoric.
The Bookin Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin, Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
I'm back with Kelly Fedoric, author of Attaboy, which is published by our friends at University of Iowa Press. Kelly, you write that, quote, only in the USA was pleasure a pathology. Can you unpack this statement for our listeners?
I guess when Rudy's having that rumination, part of it is his sort of poetic highfalutin self-justification for his own increasingly problematic alcoholism. But I think in his mind, he's referring to this sort of puritanical tradition in the American character where it's all about get up and go and, you know, keep your vices under the rug. I think he's just sort of chafing at, particularly because he's now reeling from a breakup with, you know, a bit of a do-gooder. I think he's sort of chafing at this narrative of self-startership from which he feels totally isolated as a, you know, drunk, soon to be unemployed 26-year-old working for not much longer in his father's bar.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that answer. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when you travel abroad, how different philosophies can be in different countries towards life. Like, you know, I want to live in Spain where you can take naps every day, where it's just built into the work schedule.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I lived during my master's program a little bit in the UK. My husband's from Australia. And yeah, there just seems to be a way in which pleasure is incorporated more gently into the rhythms of life. Rudy, elsewhere in that paragraph, Rudy makes a statement like, you know, only in the USA do family values senators get caught in motor inns with their pants around their knees. Like, if you sublimate your pleasure that much, it's bound to become pathological.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or dangerous.
Right. Absolutely. No idea why we do that to ourselves, but here we are. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I just moved back to Raleigh, North Carolina from Aspen, Colorado, and your character is excited just at the thought of Colorado. What about the idea of Colorado is so exciting?
I feel like for a while there, particularly because of natural cataclysms happening in California, there was a while, and I don't know if this has subsequently shifted, but where Colorado was almost being thought of as like the westward homesteader's destination in the States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what he's playing off of is Colorado is a sort of the new post-frontier West.
Yeah, I can see that. It kind of is. I mean, if you have $17 million to spend on your ranch house and $300 for a cowboy hat and all this, then
of course,
a bit different than it was in the 1800s, I'm sure.
His notion is certainly a false one. I think he would have been disappointed, probably.
Yeah. And I mean, Colorado is great.
Colorado, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful state, and they've definitely figured out how to make a whole industry off of the romanticization of cowboyism, I guess. Yeah, super interesting. And the television series Yellowstone is only magnifying that.
Of course.
It's across the border. Yeah. Well, thank you. Callie, there is a mention in jest of one's desire to bomb the Sistine Chapel because Da Vinci had a racist thought when he was nine. Can you talk about this sort of extreme reaction? It is the type of thing that you hear people say all of the time in 2024. Is this extremism?
So that's uttered by a character named Gary, who sort of the has a lot of white working class rage, sort of New York MAGA contingent. And I, it's so funny because I was just talking about that line with my husband last night. He hadn't I had not shown him anything of the book. I don't share any drafts while they're inchoate. But he thought that was a little bit on the nose, like an on the nose character, a liberal's character mischaracterization, not mischaracterization, but a liberal's somewhat ham-fisted characterization of what a reactionary Republican would say. But granted, I was writing this in 2021 based on a conversation that in the world of the novel would have happened in 2018. And I think back then, it actually was not particularly trite point for Gary, this drunken Irish American man, to be making. It's just a, sort of the casual extremism of people like him being fed up with the incursions of political correctness, what they perceive to be impinging on their territory. It's an extremely loaded conversation that I chose to deliberately make a little bit of a caricature.
And I do hear comments like this, especially going back over the last, 4 to 6 years, as you're saying. And I'm just wondering what it says about where we are as a society, but also, and this we could go down a huge rabbit hole here, but the art versus artist conversation. Do you blow up the Sistine Chapel because there was a racist thought when this person was nine? Do you stop enjoying Harry Potter because of J.K. Rowling's tweets? It's an extremely loaded conversation, and I'm not really sure what to think about it, other than, I don't think anybody would be reading Dostoevsky or anything in 2024, and that would maybe be a shame. I don't know.
It's ironic and appropriate that you say that because so I wrote the first chapter what feels like a million years ago. Otherwise, I think it's actually my weakest chapter, but at the time, and I had forgotten this until my husband reminded me, I was watching so much of that Louis C.K. filmed stage play, Horace and Pete. Did you watch that? And I thought it was just totally magnificent. And all of us, I was a diehard Louis C.K. fan, and we all went through our own period of reckoning with his misdeeds. And I don't really know where I come on the art versus artist debate. I think, am I allowed to say that I just want to take his writing at face value and enjoy it for what it is? Maybe that's an unpopular opinion. But also the excesses and the piety around these things has also dulled somewhat since Me Too, since 2020. Like I think people have a slightly more heterogeneous view, a slightly more forgiving view now, maybe. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's a tough conversation as someone who's run several bookstores. It's interesting when people come in and buy Infinite Jest or Postman by Bukowski or something, which wonderful books. Infinite Jest is obviously a work of genius, regardless of what you think of it. But then they will shame people for displaying, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone on a shelf. And it's a lot of double standards going on, probably
Very,
dependent
very true.
on the public opinion that the author is espousing.
For sure.
I'm next hoping that you can talk about the type of busted second son who is catnip for cult leaders. What does this mean?
That's a classic Jake put down of his younger brother, Meyer, who he's sort of the family charlatan, fancies himself an intellectual in opposition to his rapacious capitalist siblings. But in Jake's mind, Jake's trying to remind Marley, his daughter, that that's all hollow. It's a posture. Like, you're one of us. But I think we've all met that the lost, not always the second son, but the lost son who's yet not the natural inheritor of the family business and finds himself slightly more adrift or more more impressionable to radicalism.
Do you find in New York, do you confront cults often?
No, not really.
In San
Not yet.
Francisco, I did. That's why I'm asking. We would go down to the BART station and there would be Scientologists on one side giving stress tests and people in Guy Fawkes masks on the other side yelling at the Scientologists, and it was like a daily scene.
Oh my God. Did you ever get recruited or?
No, I didn't. Unfortunately, I think it would have been fun to like experience
Go
the attention
undercover. Yeah, write a
recruiting.
book about
And in Aspen too, I worked with someone who had escaped a cult at a bookstore, and the bookstore I worked for up there was owned by a nonprofit who is a cult, I think, as many nonprofits are. But yeah, it's interesting. So I was just curious about how one can be catnip for cult leaders. Well, Callie, finally, there's a lot more to talk about in this hilarious novel. And listeners, if these questions have piqued your interest, which I'm sure they have, that's the goal here, then this novel is for you, I promise. This is the novel for me, for sure. But finally, one of your characters, a young 6-year-old girl, is smart, but not about the things that mattered. And the example given is crossword puzzles that she can fill out. I don't know if she is who is smart, or sorry, not smart in the way that matters, or just people who complete crossword puzzles in general, but it's some surprises expressed that she knows who Winona Judd is. Can you tell us about people who are smart, but not about the things that matter?
Good question. That was drawn completely from life. I remember there was a phase, this was like right after my parents were getting divorced. I was 8 or 9 and my grades were suffering. I'm sure many nowadays school psychologists would be all in a dither with their concern. But at the time my mom was like, "You know what? I don't care about your grades. You're the only 8-year-old I know who can complete my People Weekly crossword puzzle." So I always sort of took that to heart as a sign that I had, I don't know, some kind of pragmatic intelligence that was not, that, that would inure me against, self-doubt in the academic realm. Eventually, I ended up becoming quite a big student, but at the time, I just always remembered that and thought that was really funny. Marley does. I didn't want to make Marley a brainiac or a budding intellectual per se. I think it makes more sense for her to have a developed sense of people smarts and intuition, but to not, had she been a student, that would have been too obvious an avenue for self-actualization. I think the fact that she's not really good at anything is what makes her lovable for a long time, especially as a budding writer. Like, you sense that you have a special eye for detail or a little bit of an off-kilter take on things, but there's no way to make it into anything until you're like at least 30. And living with that, like the burden of this kind of formless non-talent talent is I think a really important part of that, the like Bildungsroman aspect of Marley's character,
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that it is better to have the experience that you had, where your mom was proud of you for having the ability to complete crossword puzzles and nothing else mattered, or the ability that you may have as an 8-year-old in 2024, or the experience you may have in 2024, where school psychologists would be up in arms?
I don't know. That's a great question. It's something that I also grapple with as a mom. I've got 3 kids, and occasionally I wish my parents had cracked the whip a little bit more. Maybe I wouldn't have been such a slob in my 20s. But at the same time, that they gave me such a wide berth to explore is is so valuable. I don't know. Are you a father? Do
I
you?
am, yeah, I have a 7-year-old son. He's about to be 8 here in a couple of weeks. Yeah.
Because I don't know. Yeah, we do live now in such a sort of therapized culture. And I don't know what's best. I certainly want them to be happy more than I ever care about their ambition, but I'm also sensitive to the fact that being ambitious can make you happy. Like being, I just remember, through the angst of high school and yes, I mean, sort of being socially adrift, just getting good grades was so awesome. It was just so such an easy thing to be like, I'm good at this. I have proof that I'm reading well and learning well. And I guess I don't want them to miss out on that. I think it would be silly to think that that's not important. I think it actually is kind of important, not for me, but for you, like for the child's growing ego to just have, yes, just something actionable, in their environment that can give them confidence. Like, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And who knows? I suspect somewhere in the middle is probably the best way forward. But thank you very much, Kelly, and thank you for writing this wonderful book, which is sure to be one of the best of 2024. Listeners, I've been speaking with Kelly Fedoric, author of Attaboy, which is published by our friends at University of Iowa Press. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Jason. It was fun.
Once again, I would like to thank Callie Fedoric for joining me. Copies of Attaboy can be ordered from www.page158books.com. I would also like to thank Libro FM Audiobooks for their sponsorship. Please navigate over to Libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN, that's BOOKIN, in the promo code space to get one free audiobook and support your favorite local independent bookstore in the process. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been